Universität Hamburg.
Well, hello everyone, and I'm Doug Davis, and I'm here to talk about a kind of fiction, science fiction maybe, that may or may not exist, and it's called slipstream fiction. I know that your professor also called it crossover fiction, which might be another name for slipstream fiction. It's a new kind of speculative fiction that really might just simply be another name for postmodernism, if you ask me. No one calls themselves a slipstream writer. People grow up saying, I want to be a science fiction writer. But no one grows up saying, I'm going to be a slipstream writer. It just doesn't happen. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe one of you is sitting there in the audience and you do dream of being a slipstream writer, and I'm very sorry, you can be a slipstream writer. Pardon me. But this form of writing, it's maybe a genre, maybe it's a subgenre, maybe it's a style, maybe it's not so much a style of writing as it's a new way of reading fiction that's already been written. We just have a new sensibility of it. Now, there is a science fiction film out there, a real science fiction film made in the year 1989, and that's an important year for slipstream, but not because of this movie. For the life of me, I don't know why your professor asked me here to talk about this stinker of a movie for 45 minutes, but none of you should ever see this film. However, it is science fiction. How do we know that? Well, look at the poster. It is set in the future. It looks all cool and futuristic, complete with otherworldly aircraft. It is full of actors who appear regularly in science fiction movies. Look closely and you'll see Luke Skywalker. He's the grizzled guy who looks a little like your professor. It is also literal, this film, with its science and technology. A slipstream, the definition of a slipstream is a turbulent flow of air driven backwards by a propeller. And propellers are on planes. And look, there are planes on this poster. And this is indeed a movie about guys who fly planes in a post-apocalyptic future in which the Earth is torn by fierce winds. It's kind of like an action-adventure version of J.G. Ballard's The Wind from Nowhere. So this movie is about science and technology, and it's set in the future. It's science fiction. And now we all know what science fiction is. Slipstream the movie is not slipstream fiction, and we shall never speak of slipstream the movie again. Let's talk about slipstream fiction. So in the same year, 1989, the same year that movie of which we shall not speak was released, cyberpunk author Bruce Sterling wrote an essay in which he postulated the existence of a new literary genre that was beating the pants off of science fiction. He called this genre slipstream and provided his readers with a reading list that was a who's who of famous postmodernist novelists such as Pynchon and Don DeLillo and Kathy Acker and Kurt Vonnegut. And he gave this definition to slipstream fiction. Here it is. This is a kind of writing which simply makes you feel very strange. The way that living in the late 20th century makes you feel, if you are a person of a certain sensibility. We could call this kind of fiction novels of postmodern sensibility, but that looks pretty bad on a category rack and requires an acronym beside. So for the sake of convenience and argument, we will call these books slipstream. Now, of course, he said a lot more. It's a long essay. Do read it. It's online. He says that slipstream was not science fiction because it's not about the sense of wonder. It defied a lot of generic expectations. It's textually playful. It seemed to be a literature that was taking a lot of science fiction's best tricks and doing them better, a little differently, but better. Now, given that slipstream is a kind of multi-meaning thing, sort of vague, maybe it's postmodernism, I think we could postulate that slipstream, frankly, it's just postmodernist SF. The new wave back in the 1960s, as I'm sure you've learned, brought modernism into science fiction. And that's when authors privileged character and theme and style along with science and technology and futurity. And now we have postmodernism coming into science fiction. All of the tricks and styles of that genre. And we'll talk about those in a little bit. So We could also say, though, Slipstream is what happens when different genres are mashed up with science fiction, that it's a mashup, a crossover. It's science fiction, but just infused with other genres. Or we could say it's a self-consciously literary way of reading and writing science fiction that emphasizes character and theme and style over science and technology and futurity. And that would be, in Darko Suvin's formalist terms, it would be a literature of science fictional estrangement, but without the cognition, without that scientific rationality that links it back to the real world. It's estranging, and it looks and smells like science fiction, but it doesn't have those scientific and technical hooks that you expect in science fiction. So here we are. It's a multi-meaning thing. Let me talk about a couple Slipstream novels that and stories that come out of the mainstream community that we could call Slipstream. And these are not, I know that that your professor had you read the Neil Gaiman story and I had you read the Ted Chiang story, both great stories, but I want to talk about two other stories. I found a little short story that I really want to talk about with you. I may even read it to you. Here's a novel. Not going to read you this novel. This is a fine Slipstream novel. It's by an author named Michael Cunningham. Michael Cunningham is a pretty famous mainstream American author that got famous for a book that he wrote called The Hours. And that was made into a movie with the most expensive Hollywood A-list actresses of the day. You can see them there in that picture. And The Hours is a straight-up postmodernist revisiting of the modernist author Virginia Woolf. And the book concerns three generations of women. And this is, again, not a Slipstream novel. Three generations of women who are affected by Virginia Woolf. The first is Woolf herself, and it's in 1923, and she's writing Mrs. Dalloway and struggling with her own mental illness. And the second section or thread of the book is Mrs. Brown, and she's the wife of a World War II veteran, and she's reading Mrs. Dalloway in 1949 as she plans her husband's birthday party. And then the third is Clarissa Vaughn, who plans a party in the year 2001 to celebrate a major literary award received by her good friend and her former lover, who's dying of AIDS. Pretty complicated plot. And the situations of all three characters mirror situations experienced by Woolf's Clarissa Dalloway in Mrs. Dalloway. So you have the same characters with the same names. There's a Clarissa Dalloway, and then there's a Clarissa Vaughn. So it's a very literal, modern-day version of Woolf's character. Now, that was a very popular novel, very kind of postmodernist translation of a modernist novel. But then Cunningham did something that I think is really awesome, but it confounded many of his admirers. He did something, he wrote a book and it published it in 2005, and then he didn't publish another book until 2010, maybe because of this book. He rewrote The Hours. He basically took the same novel, the structure of The Hours, a three-part historical novel with the same characters reoccurring at three different historical moments, and he wrote a novel called Specimen Days, and he replaced the spirit of Virginia Woolf with the spirit of the American romantic poet and New Yorker Walt Whitman. And instead of sticking with the modernist stream of consciousness style that he used in The Hours is written kind of like Mrs. Dalloway, Cunningham wrote the three sections of Specimen Days in popular generic modes. He used the first section is a ghost story, the second section's the detective story, and then the third section is a science fiction story. So it goes from industrial 19th century New York to contemporary New York to New York 150 years in the future, a post-apocalyptic New York. Now, as Cunningham notes in his author's note, he played fast and loose with history. And this is one of the aspects that Bruce Sterling identifies as Slipstream, that Slipstream authors are interested in history, but they like to play with the characters. They take historical personages, but they're not writing historical novels. So it's a historical novel about New York, but a lot of that history, as Cunningham observes, is made up. And Cunningham seems to gesture, who cares? It's a story. I'm taking liberties with history. So the first story in Specimen Days is called In the Machine, and it's a ghost story. And it takes place in New York City during the Industrial Revolution as human beings confront the alienating realities of a new machine age. And the principal characters are a boy named Lucas, who's autistic, and he autistically recites Walt Whitman's poetry. And here, the poetry kind of comes out of him without meaning, so it's just a bunch of signs. And then there's a woman named Catherine, who was to marry Lucas's elder brother, and then there's a a man named Simon who was recently crushed by a machine, and Lucas has gone in to take his place in this horrible factory. And the story is that Lucas is worried that the ghost of Simon is haunting all of the machines that he's working at, and they're trying to kill him and Catherine. And the second short story, so you have three short stories. The second short story is called The Children's Crusade, and it's a kind of crime thriller. And it's set in early 21st century New York, around 2005, and it plays with the conventions of the thriller as it tracks the pursuit of a terrorist band, and this terrorist band recites Walt Whitman's poetry as a kind of terrorist mantra. And they're going around detonating bombs at random around the city. And the characters are Kat, who's a African-American woman working in the police department, then there's Simon, who's Kat's boyfriend, and then there's a little boy named Luke, who's a child terrorist. And then we go to the third story. So we go from ghost story to crime story to science fiction story. The third story is called Like Beauty, and it's a post-apocalyptic science fiction. It's set in New York 150 years in the future after a catastrophic nuclear meltdown. And in the story, New York City is overwhelmed with refugees from the first inhabited planet to be contacted by the people of Earth. So we have the principal characters are, again, they're Simon. And he's this time an android, and he has a poetry chip in him, and the poetry chip constantly recites Walt Whitman. Then you have Katarine, who's a female alien lizard, and then you have Luke, who's a homeless boy, and they're all fleeing New York to Denver, following the path of Walt Whitman, ironically, when androids are kind of outlawed and persecuted in New York City. Now, I highly recommend this book. I think it's kind of a really surprising and mind-blowing book. And a lot of people liked it, but you can always count on the New York Times to say something lousy about science fiction, to not get it. And I want to show you what the New York Times says about Michael Cunningham's book, because it's really illustrative of how Slipstream crosses different audiences. So pardon, it's a huge quote. Sorry for giving you this, but let's look at this review of Specimen Days. I'll read through it. So, Specimen Days is both a very bad book and a very brave one. In the flickering light of this ambitious new novel, the silky tour de force of the hours now looks as if, for all its surface complexity, it might actually have been too easy for Cunningham. Wolfe's airy sensibility matches up nicely with his own. In that book, he wove together three separate stories set in three different periods, with little to connect them but a thin, delicate thread of style and a fragile sort of hopefulness in the face of mortality. All three stories are about the temptation of suicide. Of course, Virginia Woolf killed herself. And everything works. The novel floats along serenely, like a boat on a gentle English stream. In contrast, the three stories, again set in three distinct times that make up Specimen Days, are arranged in a homelier, plainer fashion, one novella-sized chunk of narrative after another. To add insult to self-injury, Cunningham also chose to cast each of these stories in the form more or less of a popular genre. The first, In the Machine, is a kind of ghost story. The second, The Children's Crusade, is a police procedural. The last, Like Beauty, is science fiction. The idea, I think, is that the use of such dubiously respectable forms, such a wonderful New York Times phrase, is somehow democratic and therefore, again, a possible means of getting in touch with Cunningham's inner Walt Whitman, who saw himself as a poet of the people. The willfulness of these gestures is all too apparent. Although Cunningham gamely tries his hand at lowly genres, he can't hide his fundamental lack of sympathy or familiarity with them. Even in the strongest of the stories, In the Machine, he still seems a little embarrassed at having to conjure up an actual ghost. So, there you go. There's the kind of mainstream reception of this book, which is a Slipstream book. So, here's Slipstream. Mainstream authors suddenly write books. This is one side of Slipstream. They suddenly write books that look and smell like something other than fine literature. They're dubious, something a little stinky. Those dubiously respectable forms, one of which is science fiction. Now, on the other hand, I've yet to meet a science fiction fan who doesn't think this is quite a good book, and the science fiction, to me, does not read at all like the work of someone who doesn't have sympathy for androids and aliens that he conjures, and I've read interviews with Cunningham where he talks quite fondly of science fiction. So the idea, so the New York Times can't even get it through their heads that a literary author, someone famous author of the hours, might even have respect for science fiction. But for Cunningham, it's just a natural move into the genre. Now, the final book, Like Beauty, the science fiction novella, it's beautiful, it's touching, it's a deeply melancholic story about kinship, and in my opinion, it's the strongest of the three pieces, not the weakest. So my own take on this novel is pretty much the exact opposite of the Times reviewers, but I'm coming at it from science fiction. So that's one side of Slipstream, is that mainstream authors, all of a sudden, they're writing science fiction, but they're not marketing it as science fiction, and it's not all science fiction, and they're still concerned with character and theme, and the theme of melancholy and loss and kinship. I mean, these are the big themes of Cunningham. So on the other hand, Slipstream also happens when science fiction writers write something that's not set in our real world, but that doesn't quite fit the conventions of science fiction or fantasy. So science fiction authors like Ted Chiang, who I asked you to read, and Neil Gaiman suddenly write some kind of speculative sort of science fiction that isn't really scientific or focused on technology or science. The Chiang story I asked you to read seems like religious fiction. It's a good story, but it's religious fiction. And the Gaiman story is a Sherlock Holmes story mashed up with H.P. Lovecraft. Also a really good read, but what is it? We'll return to that question in a moment. The larger point I want to make is that this kind of fiction, we call it Slipstream, has been written for a long time, at least since the 1960s. And back then, we called it postmodernism. When you read Sterling's 1989 manifesto, again, you'll find a long list of so-called Slipstream authors, most of whom are postmodernists who started writing this kind of feeling very strange fiction in the 1960s, around the same time as science fiction's new wave. So in the new wave, you had science fiction authors discovering modernism, and then postmodernism is just brewing and bubbling up at the edges of avant-garde literary and artistic culture. So again, on Sterling's list are several big-name postmodern authors, Pynchon, Vonnegut, DeLillo, Kathy Acker, and then there's this fellow, Donald Bartlemy. And I should have given you this story in advance, but it's very short, and this fellow, Donald Bartlemy, might have pioneered the genre. So if you will allow me to take about 8 minutes, I would like to read you a story. I think it's story time. I want to read you a story from 1968, and it's called The Balloon. Let me read you this story. This story, by the way, is presently in the Norton Anthology of American Literature, which is basically the most canonical thing that you can do to a story, because this is the anthology that every American professor uses to teach American literature. So here's The Balloon, and I want to talk to you, and let's think as we're reading it, what's science fiction about it, and what isn't science fiction about it? I mean, Donald Bartlemy is not a science fiction writer, but look what he's doing. It's called The Balloon. The Balloon, beginning at a point on 14th Street, and there's a map I gave it. You can see 14th Street down there, lower Manhattan, and then the balloon goes all the way up to Central Park, that green thing on the map. The Balloon, beginning at a point on 14th Street, the exact location of which I cannot reveal, expanded northward all one night while people were sleeping until it reached the park. There, I stopped it. At dawn, the northernmost edges lay over the plaza. The free-hanging motion was frivolous and gentle, but experiencing a faint irritation at stopping, even to protect the trees, and seeing no reason the balloon should not be allowed to expand upward over the parts of the city it was already covering into the airspace to be found there, I asked the engineers to see to it. The expansion took place throughout the morning, soft, imperceptible sighing of gas through the valves. The balloon then covered 45 blocks north-south and an irregular area east-west, as many as 6 crosstown blocks on either side of the avenue in some places. That was the situation then. But it is wrong to speak of situations, implying a set of circumstances leading to some resolution, some escape of tension. There were no situations, simply the balloon hanging there, muted heavy grays and browns for the most part, contrasting with walnut and soft yellows. A deliberate lack of finish, enhanced by skillful installation, gave the surface a rough, forgotten quality. Sliding weights on the inside, carefully adjusted, anchored the great, very-shaped mass at a number of points. Now we have had a flood of original ideas in all media, works of singular beauty as well as singular milestones in the history of inflation. But at that moment, there was only this balloon, concrete, particular, hanging there. So far, this is a story about building a big dumb artifact in New York City, a balloon, and we're talking about engineering. I continue. There were reactions. Some people found the balloon interesting. as a response that seemed inadequate to the immensity of the balloon, the suddenness of its appearance over the city. On the other hand, in the absence of hysteria or other societally induced anxiety, it must be judged a calm, mature one. There was a certain amount of initial argumentation about the meaning of the balloon. This subsided because we have learned not to insist on meanings. And they are rarely even looked for now, except in cases involving the simplest, safest phenomenon. It was agreed that since the meaning of the balloon could never be known absolutely, extended discussion was pointless, or at least less purposeful than the activities of those who, for example, hung green and blue paper lanterns from the warm gray underside in certain streets, or seized the occasion to write messages on the surface announcing their availability for the performance of unnatural acts, or the availability of acquaintances. Now we're talking about language. We're talking about representation and what the balloon means, sort of straying from the thematics of science fiction. Daring children jumped, especially at those points where the balloon hovered close to a building, so that the gap between balloon and building was a matter of a few inches, or points where the balloon actually made contact, exerting an ever so slight pressure against the side of a building, so that balloon and building seemed a unity. The upper surface was so structured that a landscape was presented, small valleys as well as slight knolls or mounds. Once atop the balloon, a stroll was possible, or even a trip from one place to another. There was pleasure in being able to run down an incline, then up the opposing slope, both gently graded, or in making a leap from one side to the other. Bouncing was possible because of the pneumaticity of the surface, and even falling, if that was your wish. That all these varied motions, as well as others, were within one's possibilities in experiencing the upside of the balloon was extremely exciting for children, accustomed to the city's flat, hard skin. But the purpose of the balloon was not to amuse children. Two, the number of people, children and adults, who took advantage of the opportunities described was not so large as it might have been. A certain timidity, lack of trust in the balloon, was seen. There was, furthermore, some hostility. Because we had hidden the pumps which fed helium to the interior, and because the surface was so vast that the authorities could not determine the point of entry, that is, the point at which gas was injected, a degree of frustration was evidenced by those city officers into whose province such manifestations normally fell. The apparent purposelessness of the balloon was vexing, as was the fact that it was there at all. Had we painted in great letters, "Laboratory tests prove or 18% more effective," on the sides of the balloon, this difficulty would have been circumvented. But I could not bear to do so. On the whole, these officers were remarkably tolerant, considering the dimensions of the anomaly, this tolerance being the result of first secret tests conducted by night that convinced them that little or nothing could be done in the way of removing or destroying the balloon, and secondly, a public warmth that arose, not uncolored by touches of the aforementioned hostility toward the balloon from ordinary citizens. As a single balloon must stand for a lifetime of thinking about balloons, so each citizen expressed, in the attitude he chose, a complex of attitudes. One man might consider that the balloon had to do with the notion of sullied, as in the sentence, "The big balloon sullied the otherwise clear and radiant Manhattan sky." That is, the balloon was, in this man's view, an imposture, something inferior to the sky that had formerly been there, something interposed between the people and their sky. But in fact, it was January. The sky was dark and ugly. It was not a sky you could look up into, lying on your back in the street with pleasure, unless pleasure for you proceeded from having been threatened, from having been misused. And the underside of the balloon was a pleasure to look up into. We had seen to that. Muted grays and browns, for the most part, contrasted with walnut and soft forgotten yellows. And so, while this man was thinking sullied, still there was an admixture of pleasurable cognition in his thinking, struggling with the original perception. Another man, on the other hand, might view the balloon as if it were part of a system of unanticipated rewards, as when one's employer walks in and says, "Here, Henry, take this package of money I have wrapped for you, because we have been doing so well in the business here, and I admire the way you bruise the tulips, without which bruising your department would not be a success, or at least not the success that it is." For this man, the balloon might be a brilliantly heroic muscle and pluck exercise, even an experience poorly understood. And now you can see so much of this story is about what the balloon means as a kind of signifier hanging there. Another might say, without the example of, "It is doubtful that" would exist today in its present form, and find many to agree with him, or to argue with him. Ideas of bloat and float were introduced, as well as concepts of dream and responsibilities. Other engaged in remarkably detailed fantasies having to do with a wish either to lose themselves in the balloon or to engorge it. The private character of these wishes, of their origins, deeply buried and unknown, was such that they were not spoken of. Yet there is evidence that they were widespread. It was also argued that what was important was that what you felt when you stood under the balloon. Some people claim that they felt sheltered, warmed, as never before, while enemies of the balloon felt, or reported feeling, constrained, a heavy feeling. Critical opinion was divided, and here I've put the critical opinion on this slide. Monstrous pourings, harp, XXXXX, certain contrast with darker portions, inner joy, large square corners, conservative eclecticism that has so far governed modern balloon design, abnormal vigor, warm, soft, lazy passages. Has unity been sacrificed for a sprawling quality? Quel catastrophe! Munching. People began, in a curious way, to locate themselves in relation to aspects of the balloon. And here we're nearing the end of the story. I'll be at that place where it dips down into 47th Street, almost to the sidewalk, near the Alamo Chili House. Or, why don't we go stand on top and take the air and maybe walk about a bit, where it forms a tight curving line with the facade of the Gallery of Modern Art. Marginal intersections offered entrances with a given time duration, as well as warm, soft, lazy passages in which... But it is wrong to speak of marginal intersections. Each intersection was crucial. None could be ignored, as if, walking there, you might not find someone capable of turning your attention in a flash from old exercises to new exercises, risks and escalations. Each intersection was crucial. Meeting of balloon and building, meeting of balloon and man, meeting of balloon and balloon... It was suggested that what was admired about the balloon was finally this, that it was not limited or defined. Sometimes a bulge, blister, or subsection would carry all the way east to the river on its own initiative in the manner of an army's movements on a map, as seen in a headquarters remote from the fighting. Then that part would be, as it were, thrown back again, or would withdraw into new dispositions. The next morning, that part would have made another sortie or disappeared altogether. This ability of the balloon to shift its shape, to change, was very pleasing, especially to people whose lives were rather rigidly patterned, persons to whom change, although desired, was not available. The balloon, for the 22 days of its existence, offered the possibility, in its randomness, of mislocation of the self, in contradistinction to the grid of precise rectangular pathways under our feet. The amount of specialized training currently needed and the consequent desirability of long-term commitments has been occasioned by the steadily growing importance of complex machinery in virtually all kinds of operations. As this tendency increases, more and more people will turn, in bewildered inadequacy, to solutions for which the balloon may stand as a prototype or rough draft. I met you under the balloon. I said it was on the occasion of a return from Norway. You asked if it was mine. I said it was. The balloon, I said, is a spontaneous autobiographical disclosure, having to do with the unease I felt at your absence and with sexual deprivation. But now that your visit to Bergen has been terminated, it is no longer necessary or appropriate. Removal of the balloon was easy. Trailer trucks carried away the depleted fabric, which is now stored in West Virginia, awaiting some other time of unhappiness, sometime perhaps when we are angry with one another. End of story time. What are we going to make of this story? If that story were printed today, it would be a slipstream story. I mean, let's look at it here. What is the balloon? We can read it as science fiction. The balloon is a novum. It's a new technological thing that reconfigures Manhattan. Carl Friedman, in his excellent book, Critical Theory and Science Fiction, says that all fiction is different from reality. That's why it's called fiction. I mean, if it's reality, then we call it history or something or reporting. But fiction, there's always something new. But the thing that makes science fiction different from all other fiction is that it's the difference that makes the difference. And in this story, that's the case. The balloon is the difference is essential to the story. Its engineering is discussed. The balloon is a real artifact out there in the city. Its effects on society are logically extrapolated. So it's extrapolated. It's got a novum. The story's set in a techno-cultural setting. It's about the problems have with living in a media landscape, with being bombarded with different signs and floating things. And you go to New York City, and of course it's a vertical city, and you've got advertisements stacked up to the sky. So it makes sense to think, well, this balloon would be an advertisement, but what do you make of a sign hanging there without any signage on it? So it could be a science fiction story, but it's not a science fiction story. So let's look at the postmodern aspects of this story. First of all, a balloon like this is impossible to build. I mean, Come on, this is not a real technological artifact. For all its narrator's talk of engineering, it's not a scientific story. It's kind of a silly story. It's a fun story. It's having fun with this topic. The story is presided over by what we would call a postmodernist sense of ontological uncertainty. In Constructing Postmodernism, Brian McHale postulated that the difference between modernism and postmodernism is a difference between two dominant concerns, epistemology versus ontology. In modernist fiction, what you have is a real world out there, but everybody sees it differently, and hence the invention of techniques like stream of consciousness narration. So you go into the different minds of different characters and you see how they see the world differently, but they all see the same world. In James Joyce's Ulysses, there's a cloud floating above Dublin, and at various points in the novel, different characters, all with their own thoughts and their own views of what's going on, see the same cloud. You know you're in the same world. This we don't know. What world are we in? This isn't everyday. This isn't present-day New York City. It's not set in the future. What world could this possibly happen in? Postmodernism ditches that ontological certainty that modernist literature was so obsessed with. And it says, basically, what if no one can really agree on the meaning of the world, maybe there is no stable world out there. So we can take liberties with this world, like Cunningham does with history, and like Bartleme does with New York City. So thirdly, much of the balloon is not about the balloon. Rather, it's about language. It's about how do you describe the balloon? What's the nature of meaning? It reflects on the process of writing and making meaning itself. It's a story about words, about signs. And that makes it a meta-narrative. And that's one of the signature forms of postmodern literature, is their stories about stories, kind of recursive. Lastly, the story's resolution is personal. I mean, it's subjective. It has no necessary connection to the vast contrivance of the balloon. This guy made the balloon because he missed his girlfriend. That's hardly the meaning of the story, as there's no interesting so what at the end of the story. It was a personal meaning, but it means nothing else to anybody other than himself. Well, slipstream fiction has basically, well, I knew it made it into the official canon when I found it in my creative writing class. I teach creative writing too when I'm not doing my other work. And in my professional life, I teach American literature, and I'm the editor of the Science Fiction Research Association's review. And we recently published a very good article by your professor. You should all read it. And I knew that slipstream had made it into the official canon of literature when I came across it in a textbook that I use. And you know that something's been canonized when the creative writers start teaching it. So here's my textbook, Imaginative Writing. And I'm now in the third edition and from 2011. And once upon a time, the word genre was a dirty word in a lot of creative writing classes. I remember when I was in grad school and I would have students come up to me from their creative writing program and they wanted to write science fiction, they wanted to write fantasy, but the term genre was used as an insult. Other students in the class would read their stories and the insult would be, "That's so genre." Well, I felt sorry for them, but they were all training to be little James Joyces, so what can you do? But now, many moons later, decades later, here's a textbook by an author, Janet Burraway, and she's about as mainstream a writer as mainstream gets. And she makes a really interesting observation, and I'll just read it for you. "The tendency of recent literature is in any case to move further away from rigid categories." Doesn't that sound kind of like the balloon? "Toward a loosening or crossing of genre in the sense of literary form. Many writers are eager to experiment with pieces that blur the distinction between two genres or even follow two genre patterns at once." And here we mean big genre, story, poem, play, drama. Those are the big genres, all right, not the popular genres like science fiction, fantasy, horror. "So many writers are eager to blur those distinctions, even to follow two patterns at once. So short stories may have elements of poetry or essay. The prose poem may be seen as a lyric or a story. An essay might be structured with a refrain. So Adam Thorpe ends the novel Overton in the form of a film script. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd writes a political essay in the form of a fantasy play. Michael Chabon and others write detective or science fiction with literary ambition and intent, genre fiction pressing at the bound of the fiction genre with the results that have been called slipstream or interstitial fiction. So you have permission to now write this. Now, what this shows is that slipstream fiction and this mashing up of different genres, this authors taking science fiction and bringing it into the fold of their literature with other genres. I mean, it's not just something going on in science fiction. This is something going on across literature and indeed across culture. So I think with slipstream fiction, we really have to look at it as Raymond Williams would have us look at it. It's part of what we could call a much larger post-industrial digital media structure of feeling. Now, this is a great term that Raymond Williams coined in his 1977 book, Marxism and Literature, and elsewhere. He developed it throughout his career. And what structure of feeling refers to is each generation's artistic forms and conventions as developed in a particular world historical situation. So the industrial age has its own structure of feeling, and our post-industrial digital media age has its structure of feeling. And slipstream fiction is fiction that is deeply embedded in, I think, our late 20th century, 21st century structure of feeling. Let's go back to Sterling's definition. Sterling says, this is the kind of writing which simply makes you feel very strange. The way that living in the late 20th century makes you feel, if you are a person of a certain sensibility. So even Sterling's kind of gesturing that this is something that comes out of the moment, out of the material conditions of our existence. Except I would take issue with Bruce Sterling. I don't think this fiction feels strange at all. I think reading slipstream fiction feels right. I think that it might feel strange for Sterling because in his heart of hearts, I think that Sterling is a refugee from what Williams would call a residual form of culture. Raymond Williams posits that cultural forms exist in emergent, dominant, and then residual forms. So you have new emergent forms representing new changes in the base of society and commerce, and then you have dominant forms, and you have residual forms that are left over from past eras. So it's not like they go away, they're leftovers. And I think Bruce Sterling's a romantic. He's a very idealistic person, and he's always having fights with Marxists, and I think he thinks that technology and capitalism can save the world. That's a romantic notion. Now, reading Cunningham or Guyman or Chabon or Chang or even Bartlemé, to me, feels like the way life is now, even if the stories are all fundamentally speculative. But to me, that doesn't feel strange. They feel contemporary. I mean, isn't speculation part of the warp and woof of contemporary culture? Every gizmo we own is 1 year away from being made obsolete by the next generation of gizmo, about which there is always endless rounds of speculation. Science fiction and capitalism are deeply tied together. Both are inherently speculative ventures. I mean, science fiction arose alongside capitalism, and the slipstream fiction is the kind of fiction that fits our stage of post-industrial digital media capitalism. It's a stage of capitalism that is basically about making money off of multiple and virtual identities. I mean, there's not just one you out there. There's you in the school, and then there's Facebook you, which hopefully is a smartly censored version of you, and then there's LinkedIn you, which is a professional version of you, and then there's you as filmed from all those security cameras on every corner. So you are not an individual identity. You are multiple things depending on your interface with the machines of commerce and surveillance. And every form of culture can be morphed into any form of culture on any device with a microchip. We can watch Netflix anywhere. And literature is not an exception to this cultural development. This kind of genre bending is going on all over literature and indeed on, I think, all over the arts. It's a tendency that was once considered avant-garde and emergent in the 1960s, but now it is becoming increasingly dominant. So, I mean, let's look here. I mean, I think by the 1960s, postmodernist and slipstream literature, it was avant-garde. I mean, it was an emergent form, but by the turn of the century, it had become increasingly prevalent across culture, part of the cultural dominant of postmodernity. I mean, slipstream is a semi-creative writing textbook. It appears in the pages of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. Pretty much any slipstream story could be published in that magazine. And it also, these stories appear in The New Yorker, which is the fanciest literary magazine out there. And I think it's a part of a larger culture, a 21st century postmodernist mashup culture, mashup albums and DJ mixing and avatars, multitasking, cross-posting, Photoshop retouching, architectural reskinning and repurposing, transmedia culture, slipstream fictions, they're ever familiar mainstream effects. You can read Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow, and then you can go and watch The Simpsons, which feels a lot like reading Gravity's Rainbow with the way it plays with language and high and low puns and mashes up genres, and Thomas Pynchon was even on The Simpsons. So none of these things feel at all strange to a generation doing or making or consuming them. So let's consider an example. I think there's really very little difference across media between what Neil Gaiman has done with Sherlock and what the music producer Danger Mouse did with the Beatles and Jay-Z in his Grey album. In the Grey album, Danger Mouse mixed Jay-Z's Black album with the Beatles' White album, and the results are amazing. But what is it? Is it rap? Is it progressive rock? It's a mashup. And the result is a new organic whole, and it's a really great album, and it's completely new music. Of course, it's not Slipstream, but it comes out of the same structure of feeling as Slipstream Fiction, that you can take these forms, and they don't have an inherent identity. They're techniques that can be combined. So in effect, the Grey album is pretty much the same as Gaiman's story, because it's also a mashup. It's a mashup of Doyle and Lovecraft. I mean, what is it? A detective story? A Cthulhu story? And then Gaiman did all kinds of fun. He did all these postmodernist typographical tricks with his story. He printed it up like a broadsheet from the Victorian era. He put little wink, wink, nudge, nudge advertisements from Dr. Jekyll in it. Now, Slipstream Fiction, then, I guess we could just say it's not so strange. It's just contemporary culture. I would call it contemporary SF. Maybe not science fiction, but we can expand our sense of SF. Paulo Freilich, who I believe you have met, describes Slipstream as two or more literatures occupying the same territory. Different communities of readers and writers can approach and claim the same text, but to very different effects. It's just like that New York Times review of Cunningham. For a mainstream literary critic, the novel's lowly generic elements are a distraction from the characters and themes of the book. But for a science fiction reader, the novel's procession into a distant future of androids and aliens and space travel feels right. And by focusing on those elements, we want to claim the book as science fiction. But it's both. I mean, it's literature, it's science fiction. Call it Slipstream. Call it speculative fiction. Ted Chiang's story, which I had you read, is character-driven existentialist religious fiction set in a world extrapolated, I think in pretty rigorous science fiction fashion, from the what if. What if hell and God and angels were a visible, tangible part of our everyday world? It's a pretty cool story. I don't know of too many stories that do this. The story routinely tops the lists of Christian science fiction, but is it even science fiction? There are lots of what we call interstitial forms or subgenres out there in SF land. There's the new weird, the new wave fabulous, the new romantics, the new space operas, the steampunks. There's science fiction, but before that it was scientific fiction, and then it was speculative fiction, and then some people called it structural fabulation. But call it what you like. It's all SF, and I think that just as the new wave can most concisely be defined as the moment when modernism came to science fiction, Slipstream, not cyberpunk, but Slipstream is the moment when postmodernism really came to SF. The postmodernists like Pynchon and Bartlemy and Vonnegut had taken tricks from SF starting back in the 1960s, and now the science fiction writers and their like-minded ilk are taking their cues from the postmodernists. The line now between postmodernism and Slipstream, it's already so blurry that we want to go back and claim most of those old postmodernists as Slipstreamers all along, see them all as part of a genre. But why are writers collected in the anthology feeling very strange, a Slipstream anthology, or writing for McSweeney's, which is oftentimes full of Slipstream stories, and writing for The New Yorker? Why are they writing this way now? Why do they write Slipstream? For the same reasons writers have always written one word after the next. Because it feels like the right thing to do. And thank you, I'm done.